coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. It's Father's Day weekend, and as people celebrate the impact their dad has in their life, we look at an organization trying to help single men and those just out of prison embrace this role in their children's lives.
And I remember one guy told me, you know, if I could spend half the day with my child, that's going to give me enough incentive not to go back to jail.
We bring you a conversation with the founder of the group, Every Man Counts. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also take a closer look at the state's draft anti-discrimination regulation for schools and what it says about racial identity. And hear more about concerns raised by the Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why. Plus more work from student journalists at the University of Delaware in Enlighten Me. That's next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We start this week's show with a nod to Father's Day weekend. Being a dad can be tough for anyone, but some face a more difficult road than others. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talked to the founder of Wilmington's Every Man Counts. It's an organization that aims to help single men and men re-entering their communities after time in prison be better dads.
Ashawavi Ajavan knows from personal experience where a lot of the parents she works with are coming from.
I've been homeless. I've been a single mother raising three children by myself. I know what it is to not have a job and have to feed your kids.
Ajavan now owns a mediation consultancy near Trolley Square in Wilmington. And on the side, she runs Every Man Counts, an organization that helps single and reentry dads, and recently some moms as well, gain parenting skills. It covers everything from infant care and cooking healthy meals on a budget to braiding hair and navigating family court. I asked Ajavan what problem Every Man Counts is trying to solve in Wilmington.
Like many other urban communities, there's a large unemployment rate. There's a lot of reentry men and women are coming out of prison. The recidivism rate continues to increase.
Ajavan says while she was finishing her master's degree at Wilmington University 4 years ago, she learned there's a connection between recidivism and parenthood.
With my research, I found that Wilmington has a higher rate of children living in the homes without their male parent due to, one, incarceration or just abandonment. And the incarceration percentages was higher than abandonment. So I started focusing on that. But what is the root cause of this and what's happening and how can we fix it? So I started interviewing people, men particularly, who were in halfway houses or in detention, like work release programs, and asked questions like, what's going on? Why are you, you know, why is there the recidivism rate so high and you're not really engaged in your children's lives? And I remember one guy told me, you know, if I could spend half the day with my child, that's going to give me enough incentive not to go back to jail. So I was like, wow, you know, that's interesting. I'm like, so what's going on? He said, well, mom doesn't want to talk to me. She penalizes me for being incarcerated, despite the fact that I tried to reach out to her several times so I can be in my child's life. So I went back and started thinking, what can we do to change that? I remember talking to my professor, who is now the commissioner of DOC, Professor Phelps. And I talked to him and I, you know, I engaged him. I said, what are the issues that you're finding as a DOC worker from, you know, men and women who are being released? What's going on? And he said, those are the same things they're having issues once they come back. And they're like, the biggest thing is if I had a reason for staying out, I wouldn't want to come back.
Ajavan's thesis focused on developing programs to help incarcerated fathers find this reason. When she graduated in 2014, she put her ideas to the test. She found community partners and people willing to volunteer their time and founded Every Man Counts.
We did our first cooking with dads. We had about 24 fathers that showed up. Our next project we did was a daddy and daughter tea party. We had children from age 2 to 16 that showed up. So I said, you know, we're going to do the third leg of the project, which was fishing. One thing that a lot of the incarcerated fathers has said was, when I was younger, I went fishing with my father and I went fishing with my friends, and we would sit at the Brandywine on the bridge and throw a stick in there with a string and we would catch some fish and we'll walk home. It was the best days of our lives. But now Brandywine Creek is drying up. There's nothing to do. When we do come out, want to take our kids fishing, they're not engaged because we don't know how to get them engaged with that. So I went to Hope Commission and I talked to Charles Madden, who was then the commissioner, the director, who partnered with me and several of his staff. We put together a fishing trip. We took, I'll never forget, we took 10 guys. We had a little van, a minivan, that said eight. We took 10 guys out fishing with their kids. And let me tell you something, we didn't catch not one fish, but those kids had the best time of their lives playing with the worms. And just engaging with their fathers. And these were fathers who, if you know what the Hope Commission is, were incarcerated fathers who came out, and this was like the biggest adventure with their kids. And we thank the Hope Commission for partnering with us. So those are the programs that we started in 2014. This is 2018. Those program has extended. Our fishing trip is every year. We take fathers and their children fishing. Now we have moms that are involved. We go to North Bay Adventure Camp. It's a full day. Stubbs Elementary is one of our biggest supporter. This year we're going to have Elba Palmer, who is in second supporter, who's going to be partnering with us. We still do our daddy and daughter tea party, Stubbs Elementary again, and Wilmington Head Start. We had 175 people this year. But 132 last year. So have you see the numbers have grown.
Ajavan says Every Man Counts, or EMC's, approach was different from other fatherhood initiatives she saw in Delaware.
The work is done once a year. And the engaging process is not there. And I think that's what's missing, what I saw from several organizations that I've been that I've worked with. People don't want you to just engage them at one time. They want to know that you're still interested in them. They want to know that what you're doing is in their best interest. So continuous growth, continuous intervention is what I see that was needed and was missing. And that's what we do. So everybody looks forward to the programs we have every year. So every quarter we do at least one big program. So all of our programs are done from January to December. And each quarter we have a big program that is done. So it's continuous. We do have case management where we follow through with every father and mother that goes through, that participate in our events. We follow up with them, make sure that they're adhering to what they've learned, that if they have any questions, if the resources that have been given to them is not working, if they need additional resources, or if they just need someone to talk to. One of the perks of EMC is we don't just do the different programs. We take a holistic approach in helping fathers and helping mothers who have been incarcerated and navigating the conversation, where we add our mediation piece to it, but we help them navigate the court system. So that's something that no one else is doing besides EMC. Fathers come in who have been incarcerated for maybe, let's say, 15 years, and they come out and they're stuck with these high astronomical child support payments. Because one, they're not told that they can either modify or do something about it while they're incarcerated. So they come out, one, they have a felony against them. They can't find a job that's gonna help them pay down that cost. And if they do find a job, it's not gonna be affordable enough where they can live off and pay the child support so that it can stay out of jail. Because if you're late again a second time, you're going back to either work release or back into to prison, to jail.
So Every Man Counts offers a free 6-week employment engagement program out of the Route 9 library, which helps dads prepare resumes and cover letters or put together paperwork to start their own businesses. Then a team of volunteer social workers follows up with the dads. EMC also hosts a barbershop discussion series where volunteers teach customers the basics of child custody, placement, support, and guardianship. Ajavan says the Every Man Counts program has three requirements: The participants commit to being a consistent part of their children's lives rather than just wanting reduced child support payments, that they participate in at least one of the organization's big parent-child bonding programs throughout the year, and that they commit to mentoring another child in the community in addition to their own. She says the program is not for everyone.
We have had so many people that will come in for the consultation for EMC, and we'll tell them what our program entails and what is required, and we'll never see them again. We have a whole drawer full of people that never came back because they just didn't want to adhere to what I had to say. But I'm very real. I keep it real. I'm here to help you, but you must give back to the community.
That's Ajawavi Ajavan, founder of Every Man Counts, which has just applied for official nonprofit status. And for Delaware Public Media, I'm Sophia Schmidt.
Thanks, Sophia. And stay with us. Much of the debate over the Delaware Department of Education's controversial draft anti-discrimination regulation has centered on transgender students. But there are also concerns about how it handles race. We'll explain that next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. State education officials are working on a new anti-discrimination regulation for public schools. Regulation 225 could make Delaware the first state to allow minors to self-identify their race and gender. And while much of the debate over this draft regulation has focused on the implications for transgender students, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller reports some say the controversy over inclusion of race in the regulation came as a surprise.
Shaira Deneen is still struck by a memory from 17 years ago. That's when her first grade teacher told her to mark her race as black on a standardized test.
I told them, but I'm black and I'm white.
The University of Delaware junior laughs when asked if she's ever been tempted to challenge social constructs and identify herself as white instead of black.
I have joked that I would rather say that I'm white and see people's reaction and understand that it's the same exact thing that they did back during slavery. You know, they just automatically made someone a certain race because they had a little bit of black in them. And I have a lot of white in me, so why can't I automatically be white?
In 2017, Democratic Governor John Carney ordered the Delaware Department of Education to develop an anti-discrimination regulation for students, including both gender and race. That's after President Trump's administration withdrew guidance allowing transgender students to use bathrooms that match their gender identity. The Delaware DOE put together a team of parents, community members, and LGBTQ advocates to help write the regulation. They assumed gender would be the sticking point.
And the purpose and the reason why is because every meeting that we had had up until that point have been completely hijacked by this issue of, you know, being able to self-identify the gender.
That's Terry Hodges, a member of the team. She's a parent, active in the Delaware State PTA, and biracial. The Delaware DOE got more than 11,000 comments, and she says the team was surprised by all the attention to the race question. Many parents were outraged. One of them was Lamar Gunn. He's the Central Delaware NAACP president. He says he's raising his son to be proud of his black heritage and culture.
I am raising my kid as a strong young black male, period. Does my child have the right to say that he's a young white male? Not in my house. No.
Gunn says it should be up to parents to make important decisions around race and gender for their kids, at least until they're adults.
It's a slippery slope when we start thinking about taking rights away from parents. You know, I have the responsibility to make sure that my child goes the right way and is successful in life.
Then this spring, education officials bowed under pressure and revised the rule to require that students get parental approval. But civil rights groups say the revisions may force schools to out transgender students, which could expose them to rejection or abuse. Governor Carney defends the changes. He says he understands the risk to students, but he also has to respect the rights of parents.
I think if we start from the idea that every student ought to be cherished and every student ought to be respected, then we're going to end up with a good result.
Some Delaware high school students are split on their peers choosing their own gender and race. Amaya Williams, a junior at Mount Pleasant High School, says being mixed race is different than someone switching their race to something they're not.
If you're not going through the struggles that a black person faces on a daily basis, there's no way for you to feel black. You can appreciate black culture, you can have black friends, and you can listen to black music or whatever you do, but you're not black. You're white. And it's great that you support black people and appreciate our culture, but you can't do that.
Public comment on the revised language runs through July 6th. Sarah Mueller, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And there's more to come on The Green. But first, a look at your local news headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, based on a fictional young adult novel, chronicles the events that lead to one teen's suicide and contains depictions of mental illness, sexual assault, and cyberbullying. The show's second season is now out and is again raising serious concerns among parents, mental health professionals, and educators about appropriate ways to communicate with teens and preteens about these issues and the show's appropriateness for these age groups. The Beau Biden Foundation, which works to protect children from the threat of abuse, and the JED Foundation, an organization specializing in teen suicide prevention, are among those speaking out about 13 Reasons Why. And Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Biden Foundation Executive Director Patty Daly Lewis and Sarah Gorman, the Director of High School Programming for the JED Foundation, about the series.
All right, Patty, I want to delve into this a little bit. Give me your thoughts on this series, if you will.
Well, I have to say, I do really support having education out there, but I think it's important that parents understand that these sorts of depictions have to be part of an overall family conversation with regard to cyberbullying, appropriate internet use, sexual assault, all of the things you mentioned. Because in my experience, and I sat on the Child Death Commission for more than 15 years where we reviewed the death of every child, whether that child died from medical issues, homicide or suicide. And one of the things I think is important for parents, it's not just a one-time conversation. It's a continuing conversation and an open line of communication. And I'm concerned about young people coming home and plopping on the sofa and watching something without adult guidance to understand what all of these things mean. All of our kids, we actually had, I don't know if you're aware of this, we actually had a suicide cluster in Delaware. And the CDC came in and met with us. We went over a lot of information. And one of the things you hear very consistently in after-action reviews is that, you know, parents notice things like withdrawal, sadness, change in activities, but they factor it into, you know, a normal part of being a teenager. And that's a hard line. It's a hard line for parents to see where the normal teenage behavior is starting to go on a bad route for their kids and how to help them. So I think it's really important that families have frequent, open communication with regard to these very, very serious issues.
All right, I'm going to jump over for a moment to Sarah Gorman. She's the Director of High School Programming at the JED Foundation. Sarah, the same question to you. I want your thoughts on 13 Reasons Why.
Sure. So I agree that obviously the show touched on many important and very relevant topics for teens. You know, our concerns around the show are really just in line with most of the suicide prevention community. And we, you know, stress that for vulnerable teens, so that's teens with mental health issues or even suicidal ideation, you know, we felt that they should really take caution in watching the show, so we put that guidance out there. And we wanted to make sure that the show was not triggering for them in any way. You know, particular concerns, you know, included allowing Hannah to speak and continue to live on from the dead, especially as a ghost in the second season and the graphic depiction of the suicide in the first season. And, you know, I agree that it's also very important to make sure that parents understand that conversation between the teen and the parent and what to look out for is very important, but also that teens feel that they can go to trusted adults and talk to them when they have issues, and that the parents and other trusted adults will be able to help and will be caring and know what to do. And in some cases in the show, unfortunately, in the first season, the counselor did not respond well to Hannah's admission that she was having thoughts about suicide. And so we want to make sure that we can reinforce the message that if you're struggling, teens really should seek help and should reach out to trusted adults, that the adults will be there for them for the most part, and that, mostly in schools and elsewhere, that the parents and the trusted adults are the right people to reach out to.
Sarah, what are some of the resources that teens and parents and guardians can use from your agency?
Sure. So specifically around this show, we developed a toolkit for educators, for parents, for teens, and for the media. We participated in creating this toolkit with a coalition, an international coalition of suicide prevention organizations. And so that's available at 13reasonswhytoolkit.org. And so we encourage people to check that out. We also, last year, in collaboration with an organization called SAVE, created talking points about the first season for teens and parents. That's available on our website. And we have many resources available on our website, jedfoundation.org, a very comprehensive mental health resource center that goes into detail about a lot of different issues that may be facing teens and that also gives some advice on where to seek help in case of a crisis.
Patty, I'm going to jump back to you for a minute. Is there a collaboration between the Beau Biden Foundation and the Jed Foundation?
We have talked several times over. I know when I was with the DOJ, I often reached out to Jed. We do not have a formal MOU, but we certainly do work together and make sure that every school that we work with, we really focus with kids, particularly on cyberbullying. And we make sure that every school that we work with knows about the Jed Foundation and has the information they need to access the information that is incredibly good that has been offered to families. It's almost like a viewing guide, which is really important. We also spend a lot of time with the schools and students working with the concept of bystander intervention in cyberbullying. We know that in order for this cyberbullying to continue, it's like a fire. It needs oxygen, and the oxygen is bystanders who either participate or who go to the side of the kid who feels alone. We talk a lot with kids about that, and we give them and their families the information they need to access more advice in this topic.
Is there a specific reason? I guess this would be a more Sarah question than Patty, but is there a specific reason that many suicides start with bullying and cyberbullying?
I don't know. What we found when the CDC came into Delaware, that was not the primary reason. I think what happens, though, when you talk about a child that has suffered through bullying and cyberbullying and takes their own life, it's really a convergence of a lot of different things. When you come upon, like any child, any youth, their personalities are different. And if you come across a child who's already suffering mental illness, who's already becoming very withdrawn and having these inclinations, if that child subjected to bullying is far different from, the young woman who's the star of the school musical being subjected to bullying. How kids react to bullying is really different. And I think we can't just dismiss this as cyberbullying. I think it's really important that we focus on the mental health issues around suicide, because that is far greater in terms of my sitting in after action, after death reviews. Far more of these young people had much more deeper. Some of them had no cyberbullying issues or bullying issues at all. In fact, the vast majority had no bullying issues at all. These were kids who were suffering from a variety of depression and mental illness, and they weren't engaged at all. So I think it's important that parents know that all cyberbullying will not result in suicide, and that in most cases, suicide is not a direct, and it's, I wouldn't say direct, but it's not based upon cyberbullying. There are cases, certainly, but and I'd be interested in what the Jed Foundation, what their position on this is. But I think that we need to look at it a holistic mental health issue, not simply in a silo of cyberbullying.
Sarah, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, we don't know if bullying directly causes suicide-related behavior. That's kind of an open question. Most youth who are involved in bullying do not engage in suicide-related behavior, but it is correct to say that bullying is a risk factor for suicide. And I think it's very important to underscore, as you just said, that the broader mental health issues are really important here because they can be a common part of both the bullying and the suicidal behaviors. And I also wanted to add that it's really important to note that involvement in bullying, including witnessing bullying, can really reduce a teen's sense that the school is a safe, supportive environment, and that adults can be relied on. And we know that lack of connectedness can be really a major risk factor for suicide-related behaviors. So it's really important to make sure that, you know, when there is an issue in a school, that there are things in place to ensure that students can continue to feel safe and connected and cared for by the school environment. That's very protective against bad outcomes of mental health issues and suicide-related behaviors as well.
Sarah, do you have any suicide stats on how many young children take their lives here in Delaware each year?
Well, Delaware seems to be, and this is, I'm not an expert on Delaware in particular, but Delaware does seem to be in line with national trends in suicide, which is that highest rates of suicide are among middle-aged white males, and firearm suicides account for about half of all suicides. Suicide is generally the second leading cause of death among youth, and in recent years, we've seen somewhat of an increase in suicide-related behaviors among adolescent girls, which is, I think, probably also true in your state. So those are some of the background stats.
I will tell you that I know here in Delaware, in terms of suicide, as I indicated, in 2012, we actually had a rash of, we had 11 suicides and 116 attempted suicides between January 1st, 2012 and May 4th, 2012. So those of us who handled these issues sat down and we reached out for help from the CDC and they sent a team in here. And the fact of the matter is they found no clear pattern of what was going on. Some of these children had, and it is varied, some of them suffered from medical issues apart from mental health issues. Some of them had been bullied. Some of them were bullied. But I can tell you that the indication is that young men were more likely, in terms of the 116 attempts versus the 11 suicides, young men were more likely to accomplish the suicide than attempt. Or when they attempted, they were more likely to accomplish because they utilized firearms. We have had kids as young as 10 years old take their own lives. So I think there are risk factors, and what the team that we met with talked about, and I'm looking for the reports that I got, but that there were significant life stressors, family conflict, mental health problems that put these young folks at risk. And the other issue we talked about was making sure that there were eyes on kids that were trained. So I think what one of the things the Jed Foundation has that's really wonderful is programming for teachers and youth-serving organizations, to look for the warning signs. because the warning signs, it's not as easy as one thing. It's many things. And it's making sure that kids know they have trusted adults in their lives that they can go to. The other issue I'm going to touch back on again is talking to children generally about mental illness and making sure that that 12-year-old girl whose friend tells her, this girl's, again, much different than boys in the way they respond to this, whose friend says that they're going to kill themselves, that young woman knows what to do, that she knows who to reach out to get help for her friend. That is vitally important because one of the things we found in these investigations is that for a lot of these children, there wasn't a big, like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you did that. There was almost a, I can see that, I can understand that. So our question in return is, what can we do not just to educate on cyberbullying, but can we educate our children on how to seek help, going back to that bystander, saying, what do I do as a young person to get help from my friend? Is it, you know, am I snitching when I say Patty told me she was going to commit suicide if this didn't happen? That young girl needs to know she has to go to an adult and say, hey, I've got a problem here. Because a lot of times kids will think, you know, they can solve their own issues. And we, of course, want them to the extent possible, but they need to have adult guidance. I think that's the bystander is a really important concept that people need to work with all their children on.
Patty, you briefly touched base about the warning signs. I don't know if you want to do it or if Sarah wants to do it. For our listeners, what are some of the more flagrant, if you will, warning signs? Sarah, what are some of the warning signs?
Sure, I'll go through some of them, and then Patty should feel free to add. But I think some of the major, what we tell people to really look out for is anything that's really a change. So a change in somebody's, self-care behaviors, eating, sleeping, big change in their social behaviors, if they become suddenly more withdrawn is usually what happens. And if they change their behaviors very drastically around being online and social media and interacting with others, those are really big warning signs. So any changes in those behaviors, as well as, there are some more obvious and serious signs around, doing things like saying goodbye to people or, trying to get things in order. That can sometimes happen. But the really big things to note are when there are those changes. And that's why it's really important. And oftentimes I agree that friends, peers are the first line because they notice these things quickly, maybe in school or in social settings. And they also, are often more likely, especially in the high school environment, for peers to confide in each other than necessarily in their parents or other adults. So it's extremely important, of course, that everybody, a lot of the work that we do is that everybody around that young person is equipped to know the signs and know what to do and what to say, so that, as we like to say, that a teenager or a young adult in distress, there's really no wrong door that they can knock on, that anywhere they go, they'll be surrounded by people who know how to handle the situation.
We kind of started this interview by I ask both of you your opinions on the new series that was released last year by Netflix, 13 Reasons Why. I ask both of you to give me your opinions about the show. So I'm going to wrap it up by asking each of you. Season 2 of 13 Reasons Why is out now. Once again, we're hearing concerns among parents, mental health professionals, educators about appropriate ways to communicate with teenagers and preteens about some issues, including mental illness, sexual assault, cyberbullying, suicide. Is this show, 13 Reasons Why, Patty first, is it appropriate, in your opinion, in your professional opinion, for children to watch?
I think, first of all, you have to know your own child, right? So you can have a 15-year-old who's mature and you can have a 15-year-old who's not. I do not think this type of programming should be viewed by children alone and without prior discussion with family about what they're going to see. I also think, again, it's vitally important that families consult the JET Foundation's information and what they have available, what I refer to as a viewing guide, and before they watch it, instead of trying to answer these questions.
Sarah?
Yeah, I would say knowing your own kid is really probably the most important thing there, and understanding how they might react to the series. It does cover some very heavy topics in some very intense and graphic ways, so knowing how your teenager might respond to that is very important. I agree also that we recommend that young adults not watch this show alone, that they try to that an adult watch it with them. And that they try to avoid the sort of binge watch approach, that there's, spread out. There's a time for discussion in between episodes between parents or adults and teenagers. And then we also say, that any teen, as I said earlier, who's vulnerable, at risk, who has a history of suicidal ideation, behaviors, severe mental health issues, should really just, make sure that they understand what's involved in the show and have a really informed discussion with their parents, possibly with a mental health provider if they have one, about whether they think that they should really watch the show.
Our thanks to Biden Foundation Executive Director Patty Daly-Lewis and Sarah Gorman, the Director of High School Programming for the JED Foundation, for their time with R. Kelly Steele on The Green this week. A reminder, if you or a loved one is suffering from a mental health crisis in Delaware, call the DHSS 24/7 Crisis Hotline at 1-800-652-2929 in Newcastle County, or 1-800-345-6785 in Kent and Sussex counties. And stay with us. We close out the show with more work from UD student journalists in this week's Enlighten Me. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We're committed to highlighting student voices as part of our Enlighten Me segment here on The Green. And last month, for the first time, we put the spotlight on work produced by students at the University of Delaware. This week, we return to UD to hear more stories produced by communications majors for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime first aid journalist, director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with Morgan Zisman, who's heading into her senior year. She focused on Best Buddies, a nonprofit organization that promotes the inclusion of all people by matching people with and without disabilities to form one-on-one friendships. At UD, Morgan found that the Best Buddies experience gave one student the confidence to start his own business.
Establishing the bond of friendship by giving someone with intellectual and developmental disabilities a Best Buddy is at the core of the Best Buddies program.
You kind of find your kind of person to hang out with.
That was Daniel Owen, a 30-year-old member of the Best Buddies program. Since first joining Best Buddies about 3 years ago, Daniel found friendships with two UD students. Best Buddies helped ease the transition for Daniel when he first moved to Delaware from Kansas City almost 4 years ago.
When I came here, I didn't really have a lot of people to hang out with. So, when you meet somebody from your buddy, and then you meet their friends, and then you become friends with them, it's kind of nice.
Daniel hosted a radio show with his first buddy and continues to post podcast interviews online. He combines his love of broadcasting with baking. Daniel now has his own cookie company called Owen's Oven. He developed a website that includes recipes, photos, and links to his interviews. It is a seed of the business he hopes to open back home in Kansas City. He is always busy in the kitchen developing new recipes and baking.
He makes the best cookies I've ever had in my entire life. They're so good.
That was Katie Altamari, a sophomore elementary education major here at UD and also Daniel's current buddy. She feels spending time with Daniel and the Best Buddies program validates what she wants to do later in life.
And it's nice to have this kind of relationship because you're learning more about them outside the classroom. You're not going to get this kind of experience anywhere else.
Best Buddies touches each of the members' lives in a significant way.
Best Buddy is a good program, I would say. You make a lot of friends from it.
And because of those friendships, Daniel finds it easy to spread the word about his cookie business. Right now, he is working on a vegan cookie recipe and hopes his customers will enjoy his cookies as much as he enjoys baking them. I'm Morgan Zisman.
Thanks to UD Rising Senior Morgan Zisman. Next up is Nicole Girillo, who just completed her junior year. With students across the nation breaking barriers and becoming the first in their families to attend college, she tells us University of Delaware students have started an organization on campus specifically for this group of students.
About 34% of undergraduates across the nation are first-generation college students. We're First strives to lower that percentage. As a student-run organization, We're First helps first-generation college students navigate the higher education maze. President Andrew Garcia says it's all about connections.
So essentially what we do is we put them in contact with scholarships that they may not know were there, resources on campus that they don't really know. Our events are meant to kind of open up their comfort zone, to be able to meet new people, to really network with other people on campus, whether it's they find another study buddy or whether they find like their next best friend for college and stuff like that. We really just want them to be open, come out, try new stuff, definitely take advantage of like the resources we come up with and stuff like that.
Not only is Andrew president of We're First, he is a first-generation college student himself. He describes how his own experiences have been a main factor for why he is a part of this organization.
It was different. Usually when you're not first generation, you have a support system. Me, I'm the oldest in my family, okay. Family went to college, so it was brand new. It was a brand new experience. There was really no one to go to for like support and for like advice and things like that. So it was just a lot of learning on your feet, quick learning. And that really, depending on how you approach it, it can really set you up for failure. Mm-hmm. And that's why we really want to come in and help out students so that they don't have to worry about the little things. Yeah. And they can just focus on their degree.
We're First member, Isabella Corrales, is a senior fashion marketing major expecting to graduate this upcoming May. She says it was challenging for her to be the first in her family to attend college, but is now proud to wear the title of first-generation college student.
It was just a lot harder for me to do it just because we were all so lost on the process and not really sure where to go with it. But I think it was a really good experience for me being the first one to go to college.
We're First is there to help UD students with anything that might alleviate their worries and concerns coming into college and make their college experience as enjoyable as possible. I'm Nicole Girillo.
Thanks to UD Rising Senior Comm Major, Nicole Girillo. And we wrap up with another student heading into her senior year, Jalen Rumpf. She says that while many students live their everyday lives without giving too much thought to their health, those with chronic illness may find their health influences their every action.
I take 8 pills in the morning, 6 at night, twice a day, every single day.
Erica Woolridge is a Delaware native who graduated from Bennett College in North Carolina. Her chronic illnesses affect her daily and her career now of training and development for an energy company in Baltimore.
I have lupus, and I have fibromyalgia, and I have kidney disease. Every day there's pain, but sometimes the levels of pain are bearable. Right? You don't really realize what your tolerance is until you have to actually experience it. But today it was like really bad. So I knew that it would take me a really long time to get dressed. So I just called in a sick day.
Weeks of traveling for her job had taken a toll on her body. Illnesses like lupus and fibromyalgia cause extreme fatigue and pain. Some days are harder than others, but Erica hasn't let that slow down her passion for working. Junior Hope Moser tries to balance her health and her academic workload.
The way my doctor explains it, like, it's kind of like a roller coaster where, like, sometimes I'm down and, like, I'm fine and, like, there's nothing going on, and other times I'm at, like, the height of the roller coaster and it just starts up again and, like, there's nothing I can do about it, really, and it just happens and I get sick.
Hope has several chronic illnesses, including fibromyalgia, chronic migraines, and chronic fatigue syndrome. She explains how UD's DSS office, or Office of Disability Support Services, can be a great help to students with disabilities, including chronic illnesses.
I'm registered with the DSS office, and they know all about my stuff. And in the beginning of the semester, every semester, they send out an email to all of the professors saying, hey, this student is registered with the DSS office. These are this student's accommodations.
While the DSS office works to help students academically, there is a chronic illness advocates group for students to share some emotional and social support. Rachel DeLauder is one of the co-presidents of the group.
I wanted to join just because I guess I wasn't really finding like that outreach group with chronic illnesses here on this campus, and I don't feel like it's really, of course, broadcasted, but I didn't really find like a safe space to actually talk about that until like I saw that.
The group has counselors come in and speak about various ways to cope with illness, including meditation, proper diets, and even speaking with your professors when you need the extra help. One of her next goals is to have a fundraiser walk on campus to raise awareness and funds.
It's really important to be understanding of people and not to like jump to conclusions about someone's health status just based on the way they look. Because just because someone looks generally healthy doesn't mean that they are.
Empathy and compassion from others and the support of the Chronic Illness Advocates Group makes a difference. I'm Jalen Rumpf.
Thanks to Jalen Rumpf, as well as Morgan Zisman and Nicole Girillo, comm majors at the University of Delaware, for enlightening us this week with their campus voices. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, UD students Nicole Girillo, Jalen Rumpf, and Morgan Zisman, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.